You're listening to 1001 Album Club, where each episode we discuss a different album from Robert Emery's book, 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. For this episode, we talked about U2, Achtung Baby. In the room, I have Rob.
Achtung Schnell.
And on the line, I have Ben.
Hello.
Kyle.
Achtung Baby.
And Josh.
Hello.
Achtung Baby is the seventh studio album by Irish rock band U2. It was released on the 18th of November, 1991 on Island Records. It was produced by Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno, and the genre is alternative rock. I'm going to read from AllMusic Review, Stephen Thomas Erlewine. Reinventions rarely come as thorough and effective as Achtung Baby, an album that completely changed U2's style and sound. The crashing, unrecognizable, distorted guitars that open Zoo Station are a clear signal that U2 have traded their American pretenses for postmodern contemporary European music, drawing equally from Bowie's electronic avant-garde explorations of the late 70s and the neo-psychedelic sounds of the thriving rave and Manchester club scenes of the early 90s England. Achtung Baby sounds vibrant and endlessly inventive. Unlike their inspirations, U2 rarely experimented with song structures over the course of the album. Instead, they used the thick dance beats, swirling guitars, layers of effects, and found sounds to break traditional songs out of their constraints, revealing the tortured emotional core of their songs with the hyper-loaded arrangements. In such a dense musical setting, it isn't surprising that U2 have abandoned the political for the personal on Achtung Baby, since the music, even with its inviting rhythms, is more introspective than anthemic. Bono has never been as emotionally naked as he is on Achtung Baby, creating a feverish nightmare of broken hearts and desperate loneliness, unlike other U2 albums. It's filled with sexual imagery, much of it quite disturbing, and it ends on a disquieting note. Few bands as far into their career as U2 have recorded an album as adventurous or fulfilled their ambitions quite as successfully as they do on Achtung Baby, and the result is arguably their best album. All right, what do we think of U2, Achtung Baby?
Absolute masterpiece, their best album. Their best album, masterpiece.
I would say it might be the best, their best album.
This is my first time listening to the entirety of Achtung Baby.
Ooh, I'm all ears. What do you think, Ben?
I thought it was really cool. Sonically, it was you mentioned it, Birch. It's just so different from what came before it. Even before I knew that Eno was involved in the production, a lot of this had it was vibing similarly to the Berlin Trilogy meets Madchester.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Ben, I want to kiss you on the mouth.
Man, you'll see me in a couple weeks.
I take it back.
So can we talk the lead up to this record a little bit? Because I think that
yes, yeah, absolutely. Rattle and Hum
really hits it on that, and I think that's super important to how this album becomes what it is. Well, yeah, so absolutely. I mean, Rattle and Hum is a very important thing to bring up, because I feel like at this point, and as everyone knows, this is my favorite band in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Anything. Please take it, anything that seems like a criticism. But so at this, in 1989, they'd essentially annoyed everybody in the musical world, right? I mean, they were
Rattle and
huge.
Hum was fucking they obnoxious. Were doing,
and I love that record, but I totally get it, right? I totally get what people feel that way. I mean, the cowboy hats and all this obsession yes. with Americana stuff, right? You bring in B.B. King, you write a song about Billie Holiday, you do, all this just all on the nose, super whatever, right? Okay, so. And again, I love it, but I understand why it was too much, right? So then it goes to this famous like New Year's Eve 1989 in Dublin show, right? Where Bono says, what is it? It's the end of something for you too.
Yeah.
Right. And we need to go away and dream it all up again. Right. Okay. So you have all of this. And then Bono and the Edge were composing music for the Royal Shakespeare Company's A Clockwork Orange stage production, which is wild. Right. So they start listening to all this, KMFDM and industrial stuff. And a lot of like the guitar parts and things that would become part of Vakthang Baby were things that they wrote for the stage musical that got scrapped, right? And so I feel like that's super interesting. Also, Anthony Burgess, the author, of course, of A Clockwork Orange, hated the music that U2 wrote for the play. And I feel like that's amazing. Leading them to call him, the manager called him a mad old bugger, which I love how European this is. So I feel like that, to kind of get this picture of how different this is and what's happening, right, with them, is that they say they're going to make this change. They say they're going to do this. They get these weird influences and they go full Europe, right? I mean, they move completely from American stuff to totally now doing the same thing they did with American stuff, but with European stuff, right? And I feel like that comes through so much and you get this record from there.
Yeah, they're doing that Madchester sound. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I sense that you love U2 as well. Rattlin' Home was obviously very successful, but critics didn't like it, and that made him look like a joke. Which obviously wouldn't be the first time this happens to U2.
But I was wondering, a lot of people said that they became kind of too sincere. Like they went too hard into the
self-righteousness?
Yes.
No, I mean, well...
Well, that's what people took it as self-righteousness, right? It's okay to be like that when you're the underdog.
Right.
It's okay to be like that when you're the rock and roll band that everybody loves to go see live. But until 1987, you got one top 40 hit, right? Until 1987. And so they'd released a ton of records. They had lots of radio play, but they were this touring juggernaut with really dedicated fans, right? It's okay to be like that when you're the underdog. Once you're on the top, and Rolling Stone calls you the best band of the decade, right? And they're seen as the best rock and roll band, the most important rock and roll band of the decade. People don't take it as much anymore, right?
That's true.
Yeah, it's fascinating because the way that U2 kind of positioned themselves in the late 80s. Yeah, like you said, Josh, they were on top of the world and they did Rattle and Hum. And they did all these bizarre things, like where they did that Beatles song, Helter Skelter. Live, and they were like,
yeah, I love it.
But it's great, it's great. But they were like, we're officially taking this song away from a serial killer,
Charles Manson. No, of course, right? So it was all this, absolutely. That I think Ben hit it on the nose with self-righteous, and I don't know that they necessarily were being that way, but it was certainly taken that way. I just got the Bono memoir, and on the back, it has memoirs crushed out. And W-E instead of the W instead of the M-E. So it's like, it's a weemwar or whatever. And I was like, this is the 0.1% of what he does that people hate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you don't know that. Right. Yeah. Like how self-righteous is that to be? Like, oh, it's not about me, guys. It's about everybody. Right. And it's sincere.
No. Yeah. Yeah, and
it doesn't go the way that. So I get both sides of that with Rattle and Hum and all that success and popularity, right? It just plays differently than, I mean, when he's, with Sunday Bloody Sunday climbing the scaffolding and waving a white flag around, it plays totally differently in 1984 than it does in 1989.
It does.
So, I mean,
and I think that's okay. I think to some degree it should. You probably shouldn't have the most powerful people in the world.
No, but I'm sorry, Josh.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry, trying to cut
you
off.
Yeah. But when they were writing this record, they almost fucking broke up because they couldn't get along and decide what the direction should be. Yeah, for sure.
And growth and rebirth is hard, man.
It is hard.
And the only way out is through.
Sure. Yes.
The only way out is to go to Hanson Studios in West Berlin, apparently. That's what worked for
Iggy Pop. And to get Brian Eno.
Well, it didn't work.
And
so
Brian Eno
well.
Was jealous.
And that's why Eno came in. So they couldn't get anything done. They were there for a long time. Edge and Bono are wanting to do this experimental thing and like move away from stuff. And
yeah,
the other two are wanting to be a rock and roll band. Right. And so they bring in Brian Eno and he's what got it all together. Like not even
he's,
just
he's,
like made
he's
the sound
like,
it is,
yeah,
but
I'm really
sorry,
like,
I'm trying to cut you off, but
Eno's
yes,
role.
The mythology of this is so cool. Like,
so maybe,
yeah, yeah, U2 is the biggest band in the world. They're about to break up because their feelings are hurt because rock critics fucking hate Rattle and Hum. They're like, what are we doing? You know, they get together and they're like, what should we do? There's the Madchester sound, you know, like,
yeah,
they have all these practices. And the one song that kind of like got them all to start rowing in the same direction is One.
Yeah.
And didn't that come from, wasn't it just Daniel Lanois, the producer, recommending to Edge to just to try out the chord progression of Mysterious Ways in a different order just to see how it sounds? And that's what became One. Like they were just kind of jamming on that, and like that like evolved into what is One. And I thought, yeah, I was reading up on Eno's role. I thought it was, I think that Brian Eno is a genius on his own records, but I think he's very much a genius on other people's records, just with his methods and with his
oblique strategies.
Oh, you mean these oblique strategies?
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But I like, so Brian Eno understands that when you're working on something like this, like an album, and you're pouring your heart and soul into it, you're too close. You're too close to it.
Absolutely.
You do not have the perspective of someone
where
that's going to listen to it. So he would like spend a week with the band, watching them record, listening to the songs, talking with them, finding out where they're coming from, what they're working on. And then he would fuck off for a few months and not listen to U2, not get any updates, not be sent tapes. And then he would come back and he would listen to what they were working on just cold. And often his input, I from what I was reading, it sounds like his input when he would come back in of basically just
of
taking things out, you know, like there's too much here, take this out, like there's too much you're covering up the baseline, like you guys can hear the baseline because you're always going to hear the baseline because you're just hearing it in your head at this point, but me coming in cold, I don't hear the bass anymore, there's too much junk on top of it.
Yeah.
Just to be able to have someone like that to just like be like your band coach, you know, it's so cool. And Oblique Strategies are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Oblique Strategy is amazing. Yes.
Can you pull one for me?
It's an immense privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Ben is going to bust out.
We're going to cut
an
the deck.
Oblique Strategy.
All right.
Okay.
And we will follow it.
Okay. This one's got two bullet points. It says destroy. And then bullet point one, nothing. Bullet point two, the most important thing.
Okay.
Love it.
I think that says probably Birch.
One
goodbye,
for good
Birch.
one more for good measure.
Sure.
Use an unacceptable color.
Okay.
I love
it. What's an unacceptable color?
You tell me. It's supposed to get you thinking.
Puce.
If anyone out there isn't familiar with Brian Eno's and Brian Eno and Peter Schmidt's oblique strategies, it's really cool. It's a deck of cards that you can.
All right, guys, let's get serious.
It's a deck of cards you can go to when you are what is it?
You're blocked.
Brian
Eno.
You're blocked. You're all blocked up.
Yeah, and it's a way, you know, it's just a way to sidestep whatever's blocking you.
Yeah, I'm new to this record. I'm just going to jump in on those oblique strategies since I have the chance. We've said it once before, and I'll say it again. Alex Cornea did win the Cats Chili Cook-Off using oblique strategies cards, and he tied for first place and then lost in a hammer flipping competition and got nothing.
Yep.
Was that the same year he stepped on a nail?
No, that was a different year.
Year before.
Sorry, yeah, Kyle. This was my first time listening to this record.
Yeah,
I was
I'm very
familiar
curious,
with a few
Rob.
Of the few of the tracks. Way better than I thought it was going to be.
What did you like? What did you not like?
I didn't dislike anything. I'm not necessarily a U2 connoisseur of sorts, but this is a great rock record.
Mm-hmm.
I can
yeah.
I can I see the appeal And finding out that Eno was involved in any way, shape, or form made a little bit more sense as to why it had the qualities I liked so much.
Don't discount Daniel Lenoir.
I
from
wasn't trying to. I'm just not familiar with his works.
He plays guitar on some of this album. He's also done, you know, produced albums, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Peter Gabriel, you name it, you know, Willie Nelson.
Yeah, earlier U2 records too.
Yeah, Joshua Tree.
The one that didn't Slain Castle, right, and also Unforgettable Fire, which I feel like is one of the coolest productions of that early kind of time period that doesn't have any of this stuff to it, right? It's just recording a giant castle and throw effects on stuff, right?
Josh, I feel like you'll back me up on this.
Okay.
What's interesting about this record is they went really contemporary. They had to kind of change things up a lot. But they also kind of like the direction of the band was a little postmodern after this. Would you agree?
Yeah.
This is a defining moment for you too, for sure. I think after this, they became a pop rock band. This one was... I think they were still teetering in this direction of rock meets, dance meets a little bit experimental. And then it's not purely pop.
Well, I feel like Bono got offended by people, I guess, maybe accusing him of being like fake or whatever. Because right after this, U2 goes extremely like postmodern. They go extremely ironic. Bono starts... to play these characters.
Are you talking about The Fly?
I'm talking about The Fly, yes. I'm talking about Macbeth.
Real quick though, if we can just real quick go back to what Birch was saying. Like, yeah. I think Zooropa is the bridge. I don't think this is the bridge yet. I think Zooropa is the bridge between rock and roll band and pop artists. Because then pop just becomes, that's where I lose.
That's part three, the lemon,
Right, yeah, pop is part three, and so... I lose him there, and then I come back with some of the stuff a little later, and we'll get into that, so we don't need to talk about that, because we'll talk about it later with the club. But yeah, anyway, sorry. So back to Mephisto. Let's talk about that.
So Mephisto. It's Bono with devil horns, guys, on Zoo TV. Yeah,
and calling the president.
He called the president.
Goodness gracious, Bono.
I mean,
come on, Bono.
He can't help himself. He's the Fly.
But Kyle, you bring up a really good point that this is just a total, okay, cool. We're too sincere. We're too American. Opposite way.
Yep, that's what YouTube
has always done with everything.
180.
Everything is at 1,000,000,000%, right? It's whatever they're doing is what they're doing. And at its best, it's super sincere. And the songwriting is great. It's just this powerful, urgent. You could never do anything else but what they're doing right now, right? But when it's, you know, when it doesn't hit, it's tough.
It sinks like a Led Zeppelin.
But I think everything on this record, for the most part, hits.
I agree.
It hits pretty well.
Josh, I think every track on this record is amazing.
No, for sure, for sure.
I remember listening to this as a little kid, and even like Love is Blindness, Acrobat, I was like, these are great tracks.
Yeah. When they're these deep sort of like, there's so much to them. And even as, you know, I would have been a little younger, but, you know, maybe 10 or 11. Age. I feel like when this, well, we're close. Yeah. But if you were, I was not in middle school when this record came out. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is there's a depth to it that I listened to and got in the sense of just like how it sounds and feels that then later I got in a different way. Right. And I think that that's a trait of a good record. Right.
This is U2's best record. I don't know.
I think I still prefer Joshua Tree.
Yeah?
I'm not familiar with that many of them, but I definitely like it better than the one that they forced on my phone.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, and that's another... thing.
I'll do an episode about that one.
It's that 0.1% of stuff that they do that people are like, nope, fuck this band.
It's
right?
Pretty like, fucking you presumptuous.
You call it a way more... You put your album
ben,
on my phone.
Ben, settle down.
No.
But I'm serious, though. And I don't, Ben, look, I don't disagree with you.
I don't care how popular a band is. You can't just assume that everyone that buys a damn phone wants your fucking album.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Even though you could just delete it, even though it's just...
No, you couldn't delete it.
You couldn't delete it.
Until they put an update out.
Sounds like Mephisto has his hands in this.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So maybe I had a later version or something. Maybe I wasn't as... But yeah. Yeah.
I learned this week that apparently... Adam Clayton has a big hog, and it's on the back cover of this album.
What the fuck are you talking about, man?
I'm talking about Adam Clayton's dick. It's one of the pictures on the back of the cover, one of the squares. It's just naked Adam Clayton.
What?
Baby's arm holding an apple.
That's what. So,
okay, well, we're talking about like ridiculous things with this record. One thing I'll bring up is that, so part of what they talk about is how coming to this, like this sort of volatile nature of stuff, right? And part of it is, in a real way, you know, Edge is getting divorced, right? And so I don't know if y'all knew that or not, but as this is happening
right now,
when the record's being the thing that we're talking
just
about,
just ignore
podcast,
him, right? Don't let him in,
guys. I feel like Kyle and I really want to talk about this record. You guys just want to talk about dong.
Oh, I want to talk about
and
it.
Like,
no, but I had to bring up the dong.
Yeah, okay.
Because if I brought it up during a different episode, it'd be inappropriate.
Guys, I was really looking forward to this.
All right. No, that's good. I love it.
Those
let's
jokes,
go.
Man. Okay. I'm
biting each
you.
Other's mouths.
I'm Joshua
Rob, you're really funny.
No, I love it. Okay. All right. I love it. Thank you, Rob. You're very funny. I was just going to make a joke
hold on.
About how
I'm going to since we're totally off topic right now. I had COVID right before Christmas.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
I sent a text
was
to
it from
Rob
Rob's
being like
in your mouth?
No, I sent a text to Rob being like, well, I definitely got COVID. What do you think he sent me? What do you think Rob Ross sent me as a response to me being like, yes, I have an illness now? He sent me Down with the Sickness.
Oh, YouTube that's pretty good. Link. That's pretty good.
All right.
Not, how are you? Are you doing okay?
No, of
course.
Nope.
Was it like that really old guy on like America's Got Talent singing it?
No. Okay,
that's pretty funny.
All right, get you off topic. There you go.
Buddy, I'm sorry.
I love you too. Edge is getting divorced. I do want to hear this.
Okay, so, and he's having a super hard time with it, right? Okay, so, and he writes about how, like, you know, they did a marriage counseling, did all this stuff. And a lot of those guys got married super young, right? You know, before they were rock stars or whatever. Okay. So obviously some of that lifestyle is very challenging, right? You know, so they split up right before this album and he moves in with bass player Adam Clayton, right? And I feel like to me it was like this, oh man, my girlfriend broke up with me. Guess I got to find somebody to live with. Well, the bass player.
Oh,
and then and Adam probably was just happy that somebody wanted to talk to him, right?
Adam,
yeah,
2000.
He was often like the odd one out in that group, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
He's well, not Catholic.
Yeah, no, I mean honestly, that was that was part of it. Yeah. And they almost broke up over like religious issues where Bono thought that they couldn't. But he was told by a priest or something that you can't worship two things, God and rock and roll. So you have to pick.
Well, if and a priest so, like, says they, it's got to be true,
right? Yeah.
I thought you were going to say he wasn't welcome because he wasn't as good of a player as the rest of them.
Josh, I'm
listening. No, I mean, that's also partially true to some degree. And when you watch like the Rattle and Hum documentary, you see Bono like looking at Adam Clayton and being like, hey, don't pay attention to what Edge is doing. Stop, like, you know, there's something that's happened before probably, right? And
yeah,
it's like, just fucking follow Larry. Just it's do this so shit. True. We're going, right? And so, yeah, and he, you know, yeah, he certainly was one, but I think he brings a lot to the table, though, to be honest. Anyway, so my joke was just going to be that after 2 weeks, after 2 weeks, the Edge moves out of the house with Adam Clayton that Adam Clayton lives in into one of the cottages. So, you know, he probably got tired of hearing about, you know, bass guitar pedals, right? You know what? Moving in with your bass player when your girlfriend breaks up with you sounds like, you know, an okay move, but after 2 weeks, yeah, right?
Yeah. I think one thing, though, I do find about this, as you're bringing up effects pedals, the guitar is not just washed out in echo, right? In this, like, reverb, it has, we're listening to right now, So Cruel, it has that tremolo. There's these things that he's trying different things. They have the U2 formula. They know it works. But at the same time, it's like,
yep.
that's not going to work forever. Obviously, you know, yep. with the Rattle and Hum, they realize, oh, you know, we need to grow. We need to do
something else. This is one of the best reinventions of a band of all time.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a really carefully crafted, and you guys are right. I think Eno and just getting them into a different headspace and trying out new things. I'm sure them listening to all the electronic dance stuff. They were listening to, like, what was it? Young Gods, Nine Inch Nails, Neubauten, all those bands. So
yeah, a lot of KMFDM is what Edge talks about. Like, he got really into them. And I'm sure a lot of Al Jurgens and stuff. I mean, lots of things. Yeah.
Which I thought was the contrast. Mullen was listening to classic rock, like Blind Faith, Cream, Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could definitely tell there's going to be
tension. They were so at odds. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice little melting pot.
Yeah, for sure. You know, Flood had so much to do with it, right? So there's a lot of stuff where
it was just like an acoustic
guitar part, and then
it's a great engineer.
Put a ton of effects, did all this stuff to it, and it became this thing that sounds like this that's in our cans right now, right? Where it's not necessarily even something that Edge was really
is this the fly?
Yep.
Yeah.
Also, so interesting that
this was the first single released. Yep.
Right, because this is what they were trying to show, that like.
This is buckle up, everybody. This ain't your mama's YouTube.
Well, and also opening with Zooropa, right? I think that that's a big, or I'm sorry, with Zoo Station.
Yeah.
And so I think they're really trying to, I mean, again, they're doing what YouTube does, which is go all the way, right? You know, we are different. We're going to show you we're different in all these ways, right? And I love the way that it turned out. Yeah, the fly's great.
Yeah, the fly. They do an interesting thing that the guitar, I don't know if I even like it. The guitar sits so far in the back. It sounds like another room.
It has Birch, this, what are you talking about?
Yeah, it has this like very tiny guitar in another room. It's like a big guitar in a distant room.
The fly
room.
Is like, well, here during, we are.
During the
chorus. We're not
Birch
doing
is totally right, yeah.
that Rattle and Hum shit anymore.
It's cool though. I mean, it's interesting. I will say the solo, the tone on the guitar during the solo. Yeah.
I mean, it leads into like when they're going to do songs like Lemon, right? Like this feels like this almost like dancey kind of, you know, just the way the production is, the way that the setup is.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. The backing track has that beat. I mean, this could be a Happy Monday.
When he's doing that falsetto
song.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
remember
when
U2 was exciting and cool? Yeah.
Speaking to this record, my only experience with it, aside from like knowing some of the songs, was the, was it an MTV Music Award show where Wayne's World showed up and then Garth played a drum solo? Because it was during the Zoo, the Zoo TV tour.
Zoo TV tour?
Which was this tour.
Smackfiesta.
Yeah. My first experience with U2 as a child was watching like Dana Carvey play drums while U2 did stuff. I know that the non sequitur guys, I'm sorry.
No, that's good. Well, I believe, if I'm not wrong, that's the time when it was live and Bono used the F word saying, keep fucking up the mainstream, right?
I remember that, yeah.
Which is super interesting in so many ways, right? Because one, can you
at
really
least two ways
be like messing up the mainstream when you kind of have become the mainstream, right? I don't know. There's a lot of questions in there, right? That made it, again, feel like this, like, do I think that he's being sincere? Does he believe that? He 100% does. Could it be like out of touch a little bit? Yeah, it could be both things.
Yeah.
Josh, it's so cool that you think so much about Bono.
Oh, yeah. Did I think so much about him?
Think about like what he's thinking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess he's a big part of this band, right? I also was thinking about what Edge was thinking when he was like, all right, you know what, Adam Clayton? That's one bass pedal too far, moving off to the cottage.
I want to say the record sales, 7 million copies. Jeez. End of 1992 had sold 10 million copies.
18 million copies.
Yeah, 18 million.
Yeah, so let's...
Jesus.
I haven't looked at the comparative numbers for stuff. So as far as... I know with Joshua Tree, they had their first number one hits and they were back-to-back, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like... Did they have any number one hits in the U.S. off of this? I know one was high, but I don't know if it ever got past three or two.
Yeah, they had at least three.
Do y'all know that?
One.
What would you say?
One of the greatest.
Mysterious Ways won.
But did they make? Did they hit number one though on the Billboard?
Oh, number one. I mean, the album went to number one on the U.S. Billboard 200.
But singles
probably immediately, right?
Maybe not.
Yeah, singles. They were on the U.S. They only made the highest was 9 with Mysterious Ways.
Okay.
So the rest, The Fly went to 61, One went to number 10, even better than The Real Thing, 32, Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses, 35.
In some ways, it's kind of a return, though, to how UT was before Joshua Tree. This idea that, yes, they're selling a lot of records. They're a big band. They're doing these huge tours. And they're getting some songs in the top 40, but they're not dropping number ones back to back, right? And so, and to some degree, I think that it's part of a return kind of to what they were doing before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have to work back up to it. People weren't trusting at that time. Although I will say, I think at the time, 1991, there's so much going on in rock music that this is a great time to have this. I mean, they didn't know what Nirvana was going to do. They didn't know that 10, you know, like was going to happen. So I think that this is a really good opportunity for them to switch it up and then reintroduce themselves as this band. And, you know, anybody who's buying those albums, this is on the shelf. There you go. Yeah. So I think that did help them.
Yeah, and it's more modern, too.
Exactly.
It's going for the current person right now, right? It's not.
Exactly.
As somebody said earlier, this is not your mom's U2 or whatever, right?
Right. And I think the packaging helps. I mean, very iconic, cool packaging. They had mentioned that this is probably the best packaging they had ever done. It's very stark. Instead of just doing a black and white photo, it's, you know, it's very colorful. It has all the, it's artistic, you know.
Yep. And it's all that pop stuff. It's all this, like, it's what even better than The Real Thing is, right? It's this, like, reality beyond reality, right? It's this sort of, you know, somebody mentioned the term postmodern or this, like, you know, almost it becomes like a farce of reality, right? So. It's just going straight for that sort of, as Kyle said, it's the first and the three of these like pop records.
Yeah. It said that they abandoned their earnest public image for more lighthearted and self-deprecating one.
McFisto
became the Fly with those glasses.
The Fly.
I love that.
Right. But part of that, though, is because he had glaucoma, right? So he had to have glasses that kind of wrapped around so he could see.
Yeah. I had read a story too that that's why he always wears sunglasses, because he has like sensitivity to light.
Yeah, he's a multi-millionaire.
And even if you see him in regular like interviews and stuff, like he has those wraparounds kind of
easy thing to fix.
Also, his little devil horns are
he also has to wear those because of his glaucoma.
Medically imposed.
Well, look, I don't. Okay,
sunglasses are cool.
This is exactly what I'm talking about there. This immediate like sort of criticism of something that seems like silly or insincere about you too. And again, like I get it, you know, it's the way it's always been. And it's okay. Like, and I'm not even disagreeing with it. It's just, it's a part of their story.
Let's hear what Village Voice critic Robert Kreisgell said about it. He rated it a dud.
Oh yeah.
Please. Indicating a bad album, please. Unworthy of a review. That's what he said. Unworthy of a review.
Wow. Okay.
2 years later, he reflected on the rating. After many, many tries, Octoon Baby still sounded like a damnably diffuse U2 album to me, and I put it in the hall of unable to describe a single song, although I admittedly enjoy a few of its anthems in disguise now.
Good job,
I mean,
Robert.
To be fair, when the Edge was talking with Bob Dylan, Bobby Dylan was saying something about this record being great or whatever. And he was like, well, yeah, you know, but everyone's going to, in the future, listen to and like play your records, Bob. And he was like, no, they're going to listen to and try to play your records. They just won't know how, because they won't be able to hear what's happening because of, you know, because the way this record was made, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And honestly, a lot of it is that it's just Flood taking some of this acoustic guitar part and putting all this stuff on it. And I'll say too, like the privilege to this record is huge. And without that success that they had, this record wouldn't be what it is. And a regular rock and roll band could not make this record. A regular rock and roll band could not just go get Brian Eno because they're fighting.
Yeah,
they couldn't just have Flood turn a weird acoustic guitar part into this huge thing and have all this technical ability. And so for as much love as I have for this record and for that band, it's a huge amount of privilege they got this record made.
No, absolutely. I think you're touching on something there that we give them so much credit for reinventing themselves, but you know, they had the dollar bills to do it. Yeah. You know, like
and the cred and the connections and all the privilege, all of it. Yeah.
Obviously, the phrase "Octoon Baby" was taken from the Mel Brooks film "The Producers." Didn't know that until this week.
Yeah.
Yeah. And an interesting thing that I read, and I never put this together, and I thought about going back and listening to check, and I gave up immediately. Supposedly, they never used the word baby on any song. It was like a rule.
Oh.
Previous to this. And in my head, I was like, come on, they had to. And then I immediately was like, I'm not going to go back and try and find it. Yeah. But they use it 27 times on this record.
Crazy. 27. Wow.
Yeah. So maybe they saved them all up. They were like, all right, look, you know, we're waiting for the time to drop all the babies.
It's very Catholic of them.
Yeah. No. Yes. That is the hot take of the night. Yeah.
That was a rule I actually had for any band I was in.
No babies.
Yeah. I was just like, it's so overused and it's cliche and it's stupid. Nearly swept Rolling Stones 1992 Year of the End Reader's Poll, winning honors for Best Single, One Artist of the Year, Best Album, Best Songwriting, Bono, Best Album Cover, and Comeback of the Year. So yeah.
Interesting.
This won a Grammy Award in 1993 for Best Rock Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocal.
That's a so broad category.
Yeah, it's so weird when Grammys have like the very specific how album is actually
group or
album and then a record is single and yeah. Their terminology is strange.
So Ben and Rob, as a record that you guys weren't as familiar with, what do you think is a track that you would maybe throw onto like a, you know, a playlist or something? What's your most, what's one that you heard that was like, oh yeah, this is something that I could find another, you know, fun use for, right?
I thought the album started out strong. I thought the opening with Zoo Station was cool. And the going in from the verse into the chorus on Zoo Station, it reminded me a lot of the progression in Sinead O'Connor's Mandinka. Like I kept on waiting for them to be like, Mandinka. But that's not neither here nor there, just an observation.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I like The Fly, but
yeah.
I don't know if I'd ever put any of these songs on a playlist for myself, Josh.
Me neither, Josh. I'm sorry.
No, for sure. No, that's okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Or I don't know where I would, like, if I was... My wife would maybe like a 90s playlist or something. As far as wooing,
like maybe concerned. Mysterious Ways on like a 90s playlist or something, right?
Maybe.
If I was putting a 90s dance mix on, I could definitely see something like Mysterious Ways, or even better than The Real Thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think One is kind of a good like sort of ballady thing to maybe put on something.
It's a really good ballad. Am I crazy, Josh? Tell me what version of One I'm thinking of, because I was definitely not thinking of this version. There must be a live version that they play on the radio or something, because when I reheard it, I was like, wait.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
There's no darkness imprisoning me, all that I see, absolute horror in any of this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That might be a different song, though.
That's me applauding myself. Thank you,
Did you know that... Rob. Chris Cornell, you can watch a video of Chris Cornell singing Metallica's One lyrics over top of the progression for U2's One.
What?
Yes.
What? No. That's amazing. What?
Oh my God. Put it.
And it works.
Put a link in the description.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
yeah. Total positive for me. I mean, I think U2 has never been like the band for me, mm-hmm. but I've always respected and I really like their anthemic, you know, the way they present the sort of, I don't know, these like grand open kind of cathartic songs, I guess you would say. They have these big choruses, and I think that there's enough going on in here that it's one of their, if it's not their best album, it's, you know, top two or three, I would say, just in terms of production, ideas, and playing.
Hmm.
The only detractor is some of the lyrics are a little like, eh, not the best, but it's kind of split in that way. I do think that half of the lyrics are good, and then half of them are a little like, eh, it's not the best. We just listened to Ultraviolet, which I think is like a little weaker one. But obviously,
I think that all 27 babies were in Ultraviolet.
Yeah, it might have been.
Because they're in groups of three, and I think he does it 9 times.
That would do it.
The baby, well, it makes sense. Baby. But this
I wonder if they saved one, if they're 26 and they saved one for the for the album title, right? I don't know if that counts.
Yeah. Well, they don't say it, though. They don't say
Actum Baby. Yeah, no, that's fair.
This is going to be a positive for me. This was an enjoyable listen this week. I thought it was impressive that they were able to transform themselves and go through a painful rebirth. These songs sound like they would fill a stadium very nicely. I like the production. I like the guitar tones that the Edge gets on some of these songs, like where it's just like grinding and metallic. It's not just like the traditional like delay reverb that I'm associate mm-hmm. with him. So it's cool to see him expand his palette a bit. I always love seeing Brian Eno's name on some production credits. This is so positive for me.
Yeah, I'm also a positive on it. First time full listen, and oddly surprised by how much I enjoyed the record. Nothing I'll probably revisit in the future. It's still not my, you know, most favorite thing of all time, but like they clearly had they'd figured something out.
Yeah,
and it's cool to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think it's great all the way around. I think they benefited heavily from all the help that they got. But I think at the end of the day, they had a great idea of what they wanted to do, good songs, and they were able to find a way to make it work, right?
For sure.
And I do think it's maybe their most powerful record in some ways. I don't know if it's their best or my favorite or the most important. I mean, and it could be argued that it's any or all of those things, but I think it's the most powerful.
Cool. Well, what's your favorite? Just curious.
Oh, Unforgettable Fire is probably my favorite.
Oh, nice.
I'm a war boy.
What's up?
I'm a war boy. War.
War is great. Yeah. I don't know if you said war or boy, because they're both different records.
I know. So
I didn't know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Next time we'll be talking about the KLF, the White Room.
Woo!
All right. Thanks, y'all. Disappoint you or leave a bad taste.